Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. If you're like most people, you've given only limited thought to the fluoride in tap water. That is, unless you live in one of the 15 communities in Pennsylvania that have, since 2008, either moved to discontinue water fluoridation or stop it from starting in the first place. The Bellefonte Water Authority in Center County is the most recent case. The water authority there voted to end the practice. Some area dentists and residents fought back. Why is this long-standing practice still so controversial? And what are the benefits and risks of fluoridating drinking water? Here to talk about that are Dr. Richard Miller, a general dentist with Bellefonte Family Dentistry in Bellefonte. He opposes the Bellefonte Water Authority's decision. Joining us by telephone from Culver City, California, is Michael Connett, executive director of the Fluoride Action Network, an international coalition aimed at ending water fluoridation. And from WITF in Harrisburg are doctors Sharon Watkins, director of the Bureau of Epidemiology, and Farhad Ahmed, Health Assessment Section Chief of the Bureau of Epidemiology, both with the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patty.
We'll begin with you, Dr. Watkins. The first public water system began fluoridation in 1945 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The move was controversial then. It's still controversial 70 years later. Give us a brief history of how and why this practice started.
Sure, I'd love to. Fluoridation became an official policy here in the United States in 1951 and was recommended by the United States Public Health Service. Water fluoridation by 1960 was widely used. When you look at 2012, nearly 75% of the U.S. population is served by public water supplies and drink water with fluoride levels in them. This is a public health success story, and fluoride was added to water in most communities because of the very dramatic reduction in dental caries and improvement in dental health.
Dr. Miller, although we are going to focus our discussion on water fluoridation in general, the case in Bellefonte did prompt this conversation. Briefly, the State Department of Environmental Protection inspected Bellefonte's water facility back in March, found deficiencies in their fluoridation program, and ordered upgrades if the practice is to continue. Water fluoridation is not mandated by the state, and DEP takes no official position on the practice. However, they do oversee that the program is run safely. They say that a new storage facility with appropriate safety measures is needed, which is estimated to cost about $317,000. Fluoride will run, according to estimates, another $21,000 per year. Why are you fighting the Water Authority's decision to discontinue fluoridation?
Because I believe that the money that we're going to put into keeping the fluoride in the water will, in the long run, save the community itself money as well as pain and problems with their teeth.
Michael Connors, if the American Dental Association, the American Medical Association, the Centers for Disease Control, if they all say that water fluoridation is good policy, why should we question that?
Well, first of all, most of the Western world disagrees with us on that. If you look to Europe, 97% of European water supplies do not add fluoride to their water supply because they've made a decision that fluoride is not an appropriate chemical to be adding to public water. With all other chemicals that you add to the water supply, those chemicals treat the water, like chlorine kills the bacteria so that when you drink the water, you don't get sick. Fluoride is a very unique situation. It's the only chemical we're adding that doesn't treat the water. It treats you, the consumer, with what is defined as a medicine. Fluoride is there to reduce tooth decay, a disease. So there's no other chemical that we add to water for purposes of medication. To add a medicine to water raises a whole bunch of problems. So there's a real question of choice, especially in an age where fluoride is widespread. If you want to get fluoride, it's very easy and very cheap. You can just go to the grocery store and buy a tube of toothpaste. Virtually all toothpaste today contains fluoride. So there's no real need anymore to be adding it to everyone's water supply, whether they want it or not.
Dr. Ahmed, Michael Connett raises an interesting point. There is adequate fluoride available from so many other sources, which was not the case in 1945 when we first started fluoridating water.
Not all water have the adequate amount of fluoride in it. We know that it naturally occurs almost every water source, but there's not enough to prevent.
Right, but his point is that you don't need it in water, that there are other sources, for instance, toothpaste and fluoridated gels, for example.
I mean, I think one of the reasons that the addition of fluoride to public water supplies has been such a big success is that we don't have to think about it. And I think that's the point, is that by adding small amounts of fluoride to our water supply in these communities, we are offering community-wide protection without consumers needing to make a choice and judge whether their toothpaste or their other products contain this product, this mineral.
Well, I think some people would say that there's a moral dimension to what you just said, but before we explore that, it's often said that the dose makes the poison. The CDC recommends fluoride not be given to babies younger than 6 months, that infant formula should be prepared with non-fluoridated water. And with fluoride coming to us in so many different forms, in the food that we eat, in products that have been made with fluoridated water, how is it possible to actually know or monitor the total dosage that any one of us is receiving at any given time?
Well, let me just say that any of the levels that are recommended by the CDC or any of the regulatory authorities have built-in safety factors. And with any kind of public widespread program such as this, there are going to be caveats, you know, for our very youngest members of society, or in some cases for other measures, those that have other health conditions. So I think what's important to remember is that the American Dental Association, CDC, the American Medical Association, and the World Health Organization all support community water fluoridation, and that recent studies and recent reviews of these studies have still come out and said that this is still the best public policy, the best public health policy we can have.
Michael Connor, could you chime in?
Yes. Well, I would start by noting that when we started this fluoridation policy back in the 1940s and 1950s, public health officials knew that children would get dental fluorosis as a result of adding fluoride to water. Dental fluorosis is a condition of the teeth marked by splotching, white staining, sometimes brown staining of the teeth from ingesting too much fluoride. And at that time, public health officials said that they should limit dental fluorosis to only 10% of children in the population. That was the goal. And beyond 10% was considered an unsafe level of fluoride for the population. Well, today, according to the Centers for Disease Control's most recent data, 41% of American children now have dental fluorosis.
And according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, it's 49% of older children.
Yes, you're looking at in the 40% range, 50% range, depending on the community. Some communities now have rates upwards of 70%. So there's no question today that the level of fluoride exposure vastly exceeds what it was back in the 1950s, and yet we're still adding this chemical to our water. And it's not just dental fluorosis. Dental fluorosis is just a visible sign that a child has ingested too much of this very toxic substance, fluoride. Now, there are many other risks that we didn't appreciate back in the 1950s, because we knew virtually nothing about how fluoride affected human health back then. And just to give you an example, in 2014, a Harvard scientist, Dr. Philippe Grandjean, published a paper in The Lancet, a prestigious medical journal, where he concluded that fluoride is now one of only 12 chemicals that we know damage the developing human brain. So it's in the class like lead, a class like mercury. So we're dealing now with a known neurotoxin, a chemical that is known to damage the developing brain. We had absolutely no idea about that when this policy first began.
Well, let me get the doctors to respond to that, beginning with you, Dr. Miller.
I think with the study, I'd like to know what the actual dosage was that caused the actual brain damage. I think just kind of taking a step back from what we were talking about with fluoride, in order for fluoride to work and actually protect teeth, you need to constantly be exposing your mouth and your teeth to it day in and day out. And that's why water fluoridation in theory works, because your teeth are constantly being remineralized and demineralized. And during that remineralization process, if the fluoride is taken into the teeth appropriately at the right dosage, your teeth will be more resilient to decay.
Well, let me just say that all of the agencies concede that the action of fluoride, its benefit, is from topical use.
Yes, we're ingesting it, but then it gets incorporated into our saliva, and therefore we're constantly being exposed throughout the day. And that's as long as it's kept at that minimum level, it is safe. I think what Michael's bringing up is when you have other resources of fluoride coming in and it starts to accumulate in the body. However, the levels that it's not the FDA, but the EPA regulates our water authority.
Well, the Department of Health and Human Services recommends the levels that are in our water systems.
Yeah. That level is at the appropriate dosage that it's not going to cause the brain damage and things that Michael's bringing up.
Doctors?
Well, I would say that that's not the position of the Harvard scientists that are now looking into this neurotoxicity concern. Dr. Philippe Grandjean has taken the position that fluoridated water in combination with all the other sources of fluoride that we are now exposed to could well be damaging certain people's brains. And for that matter, thyroid gland and endocrine system. We know far too little today about the particular doses that caused a particular harm amongst particular people. There's a great urgent need for better science, which has been grossly lacking here in the United States,
well,
because the U.S. health establishment has not been.
I think you're making a great point that there is a need for better science. And when you compare fluoride to lead, I mean, to me, is not necessarily a comparison that can be made. It is well known that there is no dose of lead on the developing fetus or young children that is safe, and that's been well documented. There is no threshold. There's no lower level that no effect happens. I don't believe that the science and the research and the body of research is out there to actually support that comparison between fluoride and lead.
Well, last year, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services revised the recommended level of fluoride in water. That was the first change since 1962 because of the growing evidence that children were getting too much. So, first of all, what did it take to get the Department of Health and Human Services to revise their recommendation? And for how long were Americans being overexposed?
Well, I would say that's a great question. It took a long time for them to finally accept what virtually all researchers were reporting, which is that American children today are getting far more fluoride than was the case back in the 1950s. And that, again, is demonstrated by this visible condition called dental fluorosis, which now is sort of epidemic in the United States, with over 40% of children now having the condition. With fluoridation, we have a situation where it's become sort of an orthodoxy. It's become an almost unthinking policy. It's an easy policy. And I think bureaucracies tend to gravitate towards easy solutions that don't require much political will. And if we really wanted to tackle today the real dental crisis in the United States, we would be looking at providing real dental care for those communities that don't have it. Because we have today in the United States millions and millions of Americans who cannot afford a dentist. They basically have to go to an emergency room to get dental care.
51% of American children don't see a dentist every year. And so when I look at that $317,000 to upgrade Bellefonte's system, I wonder, is there possibly a better way of using those resources? Dr. Miller.
Yes, and you have a situation today. One policy that's been proposed is to allow what are known as dental therapists, which are non-dentists, to come into communities that do not have access to dentists and to provide basic dental care like tooth extractions and fillings. But what you have is you have organized dentistry like the American Dental Association that is adamantly opposed to that. They're adamantly opposed to providing these dental therapists who can provide real dental care to disadvantaged communities. And instead, they promote this fluoridation policy, but I don't think it's an illusory solution.
Okay.
Adding cheap industrial fluoride chemicals to the water supply has been proven not to prevent the oral health crises that we find in low-income communities.
Dr. Miller.
The reason that the ADA is being a little bit hesitant to let these dental therapists have, you know, free range is because these are people doing actual, like, procedures on people that might not have the training necessary, because we have to go through pretty like a good amount of training to do what we do. So I kind of can side with the ADA when they're trying to hold these dental therapists back. I do think that there is a need to cover these, especially children and adults that aren't being treated, because I know, and especially in rural areas, it's very hard for people to get to the dentist as well as afford one.
And there are lots of dentists who don't want to practice in these remote areas of our state.
Yes, and I could see why a dental therapist of some sort would be applicable, especially in those areas. But what Michael's saying about the ADA being holding back, I think, is just because they want to make sure they get the proper training so that they're not hurting people.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. We're talking about why 70 years after the first public water system in the U.S. began water fluoridation, the issue is still so controversial. Our guests are Dr. Richard Miller of Bellefonte Family Dentistry, Michael Conant of the Fluoride Action Network, and Dr. Sharon Watkins and Farhad Ahmed from the Pennsylvania Department of Health. As follow-up to something that Michael Conant said, in July 2013, in a review published online in Mayo Clinical Proceedings, over 100 contemporary medical practices have subsequently been reversed over the last 10 years. I think most listeners will recall hormone replacement therapy as an example of a medical reversal. I also think of someone like Dr. Barry Marshall, the Nobel Prize-winning Australian physician, who was ridiculed for years for his theories that bacteria caused peptic ulcers. The medical community held fast to its belief that they were caused by stress or spicy foods or too much acid. And Dr. Marshall infected and cured himself to prove that using antibiotics would use. I only use that to say, despite the best of intentions, is it possible that the circumstances surrounding water fluoridation have changed and that it isn't the right thing to be doing?
So public health would say no. I mean, I think we're very grateful and, you know, always interested when the levels have been reviewed, and in this case they have. And it's interesting, they did not recommend removing fluoride as an additive to water. They simply revised the level. I would also point out that here in Pennsylvania, you know, we're a large state, and most of the Pennsylvanians have fluoride in their water. A little over half of Pennsylvanians have fluoride in their water. But it's really being added to most of the larger water systems in our state, so the Pittsburgh area and Pennsylvania. So a large number of our rural citizens who may have less access to dentistry, less access to some of the things that we talked about a little earlier, those are the communities that, you know, also could be benefiting from wider fluoride use.
Well, let's ask this, because Pennsylvania ranks 40th nationwide in terms of water fluoridation. There are 2,017 water systems in the state, and only 198 of them add fluoride. As you mentioned, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, which have the largest populations, do fluoridate. Is there any evidence to suggest that there is better dental health in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia than, say, Adams County, where there is no water fluoridation?
And that would be an interesting study in comparison. But we don't necessarily have that data available. What we do know is that the CDC has indicated this is one of the 10 public health success stories of the century. I think that looking at it from a much larger population level, fluoridation works.
How, Michael Conant, does water fluoridation compare with other countries? Japan, for example, has no water fluoridation. In terms of dental health, how do they compare to Americans?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, because here in the United States, you'll typically hear that, you know, we've seen this great decline in tooth decay over the past 50 years, which is correct, and that the reason we've seen this great decline in tooth decay is because we started adding fluoride to water. So on its surface, it sounds, okay, that makes sense. But when you broaden the perspective and you look at the rest of the industrialized world, like Europe and Japan, you see the exact same declines in tooth decay. In fact, the decline in tooth decay in Europe has been significantly sharper and greater than here in the United States. And they don't fluoridate their water. So clearly other factors have been playing the predominant role in this decline in tooth decay. And I would also encourage people to take a step back and look at I think, from a sort of common sense perspective. We now know today, according to the Centers for Disease Control, that fluoride's predominant benefit, whatever that is, comes from the topical contact with the teeth, meaning when fluoride works best, when it's directly in contact with the outside of the tooth, not when you swallow it. So why not shift away from a policy which forces everyone in the population to be swallowing fluoride every day, swallowing a chemical which is a known endocrine disruptor and neurotoxin, and allow people, like in Europe, if they want to use fluoride, allow them to use it in toothpaste, in lozenges, and in forms that they have the choice and the right to use, and where they use it on the teeth, which is the only tissue in the body that stands to benefit. So we're not talking here about banning fluoride, about preventing people from using fluoride. We're just talking about a more sensible way of using it, where you minimize the risk and maximize the benefit.
Dr. Ahmed, how about that? How about allowing Americans to choose whether to drink fluoridated water or not? And I'd like to add to that, that more than half of all Americans drink bottled water. About a third of the public consumes it regularly, and it's driven by public concern about tap water quality. And the CDC and the ADA and the American Academy of Pediatrics say that if you are drinking bottled water, you should assume that you are not getting optimal levels of fluoride, which means that a lot of the water that's being fluoridated isn't going to consumers anyway.
We have seen that studies conducted for the last 60 years have shown that fluoridation of community water is safe, effective, in preventing dental decay in both children and adults. And this has been shown over and over again for the last 60, 70 years. And like it was mentioned previously, the ADA, the U.S. Public Health Service, AMA, and WHO all support community water fluoridation.
But yes, you're not addressing Michael Conant's point that since it's already been conceded that its major benefit is topical, why not, because there are so many abundant sources of fluoride in topical formulations, that's how Americans get it. And I will add that the CDC says that, quote, although the comparative degree of measurable benefit has been reduced recently as our fluoride sources have become available in non-fluoridated areas, the benefits of water fluoridation are still clearly evident. But they acknowledge that topical fluoride is the major mechanism by which fluoride works.
I mean, I think you answered the question for us. I mean, we're public health professionals, and we look for the CDC and our other lead agencies on, you know, what works and what doesn't. And we follow the data, and the data at this point still says that community-based fluoridation is a safe and an effective way to go.
And also, it needs to be, your teeth need to be constantly exposed to it. It can't be just once in a while. I think having it in the water and it's incorporated into your saliva at a minimum, at a certain concentration will help prevent decay.
Well, I want to go back to something that Dr. Watkins said earlier, that water fluoridation allows us to get the benefit without thinking much about it. And that brings me back to this whole idea of the CDC's recommendation that fluoride not be given to babies younger than 6 months, and that infant formula should be prepared with non-fluoridated water. Most Americans don't give this much thought. Do most young mothers think about whether they're giving their babies fluoridated water or not?
Unfortunately, the answer is no, because they're not being informed by health authorities. I think most Americans have no idea
The government's recommendation.
Yeah, and the ADA itself, back in, I think it was 2006, came out with a recommendation that mothers who are using infant formula use fluoride-free water instead of fluoridated water because of the risks of dental fluorosis from exposing newborn babies to fluoride. And this goes back to the fact that when they started fluoridation back in the 1940s and 1950s, they thought babies would be the target benefit for fluoridation, because they thought that babies needed to swallow the fluoride and it would get into the developing teeth and make the teeth stronger for life. And so today, it's just the opposite. We now know that babies are the population that needs fluoride the least because they don't have teeth, and it's a topical benefit. So a lot of the basic assumptions that sort of started this policy have been found to be incorrect, and yet the policy keeps on going. It keeps on going. It's become sort of institutional dogma, an unthinking policy. And we really should be looking to follow Europe's lead. There's no need to be forcing everyone in the population to be consuming the substance any longer.
And the truth of the matter is only 1% of our drinking water, our tap water, is used for drinking purposes. The other 99% is used to water our lawns, clean our clothes, and so forth. But I want to end with this because we have just a minute remaining. You know, as far as I can tell, wanting what's best for our children and for public health is the only goal both sides seem to share. So I'd like to know, beginning with you, Dr. Miller, where do we go from here? Is there a study that could settle this once and for all?
That's a good question. I think that we just need to find out what is that dosage, that concentration, which I think we do have at the 0.7 to 1.2 mgs per liter in our water fluoridation program. But I think having that minimum concentration is the answer. Babies, even though they don't have all of their teeth, all their adult teeth, they're still developing. The fluoride can get incorporated into the teeth that way. And I think it's the way to go,
Dr. Watkins?
I think that ongoing studies are always a good thing. We should always refresh our science and make sure we're doing the very best thing. And I also think that, you know, dialogue of young mothers with their providers as to what is best for their children, not just fluoridated water, but all the other decisions mothers have to make with parents have to make with young babies. It's important for them to continue dialogue and just to make sure that that's on the agenda.
Dr. Ahmed?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Watkins. I mean, this is an issue that needs more research, and we in public health make our decision based on studies and research, and that should continue. Maybe in the future we'll make a different decision, but right now, based on what we have seen through studies, through recommendations from HHS and CDC and others, we still think that fluoridation is a success story and should continue fluoridation of community water.
Michael Connett?
And I would reiterate again that I think we really should be looking to follow Europe's lead and make fluoride an individual health care decision. And for those people who want to use fluoride, the safest way to use it is through individual products like toothpaste, but be very careful about swallowing it, but be using it through individual products so that you have the choice whether to use it. You can minimize the swallowing of this chemical, which, as we discussed earlier, is now linked to some serious health concerns, including damage to the developing brain and damage to the thyroid gland. There's far too many risks to continue to be forcing everyone in the population to be ingesting.
And I'm sure there could be some debate. Thank you all so very much for talking with us. That was Michael Connett with the Fluoride Action Network. Also with us, Dr. Richard Miller of Bellefonte Family Dentistry, Drs. Sharon Watkins and Farhid Hamed from the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Thank you all so much for talking with us. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.